Welcome to the Flow Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It's 2:54 p.m. and that is Central Time. Today is August 2nd. Thought we'd kick off with the semiconductors index. It got up to test the 3000 level again in here today. It wasn't quite able to hold it. And we still have the sequence of lower rally highs that really began at the end of last year. So this is the first area of potential resistance. And it's yet to be seen whether a good number of indices that are in exactly the same position are going to have the wherewithal to push on from here. So we've had the oversold condition unwound. Let's just simply look at one of those more popular momentum indicators like the stochastics index. It's back in overbought territory. If we look at these are, of course, the longer ones, but even if we look at shorter ones, they've been in oversold, or excuse me, overbought territory now for a while. So short-term oversold conditions have been replaced with short-term overbought conditions. I've been wavering on whether I should just close out my NASDAQ short and take the profit, but I've resolved at least to wait for some additional strength, and that hasn't really materialized. So when we think about the NASDAQ index, we're sort of in the same position here. We've had a good size rebound. It's even broken the sequence of lower rally highs. But we're still in the region of the lower side of the overhead trading range and the region of the 200-day moving average. And the index was in negative territory today, not in a dynamic manner. But it's not pushing up either. So there are a couple of different factors, but I think perhaps the most important is the PMI. So we have an inverted yield curve, and the difference between the 10-year and the 3-month has continued to contract. I think it's down now to about 25 basis points. So this has been a really phenomenally quick decline. But the PMI is one of the things that economists really pay attention to. And it was released yesterday and was not as bad as expected. So, investors, and I've certainly been attuned to this question about whether we're in a recession now or not. But I think that's missing the point. It's not a question of whether this is already a recession, but rather, are we moving towards a period of significant volatility and panic about the trajectory of the economy, because that's where stock market returns really come under threat. What we've had is two negative quarters of growth, and we've never had a recession where the PMI wasn't below 50. So this is a different situation, and it is always a dangerous thing to say in markets that this time is different. But we've had an extraordinary couple of years where we've had this incredible quantity of money printed, and money supply growth is now negative. So I've described it as the pendulum effect, that we swung too far in one direction with money creation. Now we're swinging back in the other direction. So we had one of the deepest declines in history, one of the biggest money printing events in history, a really phenomenally large advance in the stock market, and a swift economic recovery, and a much swifter economic recovery than we saw after the credit crisis in 2008. Subsequently, we're getting the fastest pace of interest rate hikes and the biggest inflation figures in decades. So, again, these are very extreme movements, but the magnitude of these movements is likely to moderate over time. So we swing one way, we swing the other way, we don't go quite as back in the opposite direction on each one of those swings. So eventually things will settle down, would be my main point. There's another way of thinking about it. I saw somebody, I can't remember who, over the last couple of days describing it as watching the pig move through the python. And eventually the Python is going to poop it out, but and look like a normal snake again. But the reality is that until that happens, it's going to look like a very weird phenomenon. And that's, I think, also similar to what we have in the markets right now, that we have a lot of conflicting evidence. And there's a tendency to look at the kinds of things that have worked in the past and say, well, this is something that's always worked before, so therefore it's going to work now. But that hasn't been the case for a year. So we've had lots of different instances where things that would normally have happened haven't happened. And we've had huge quantities of money printed and taken out, interest rate hikes that have gone way beyond expectations, inflation that's gone way beyond expectations. And then at this, every time then something happens, people think that it's going to last forever. And this view that inflation's entrenched. But money supply growth going negative is going to start sucking liquidity out of the market. And it's, I think, more likely than not that we're going to have a growth shock. But that it doesn't necessarily mean that we're seeing it now. We've had GDP figures that have been negative, and we've seen stock markets that have gone up. Now, in here today, we have a number of Fed officials basically saying that they're nowhere near pivoting. So we've had two upside key reversals, and I think these are potentially important. We've had a 10-year, the 10-year yield up 19 basis points. Now, that's about as clear an upside key day reversal as one might hope for. And it's doing so in a really quite dynamic manner. And it suggests that this is looking increasingly like a failed downside break below 2.75. Excuse me, let me just put the cursor there. So more like 2.7. And if that's the case, well, then we're going to see additional upside in the yield. And that was also accompanied by another upside key reversal for the US dollar. Now, not quite as emphatic, but very clearly occurring from the first area of potential support. So in the broadcasts over the last few days, I've been talking about this, that we're at the first area of potential support for the dollar and the first area of potential resistance for many of the major indices. So we're starting to see evidence of some support coming through for the dollar and some willingness to give the benefit of the doubt to the Fed that they're going to continue to raise rates. And one thing that I think very few people tend to pay attention to, but is really exceptionally important, is that the size of the Fed's balance sheet contraction is going to accelerate in September. And it's going to start contracting by 95 billion a month instead of 47 and a half. So that's important because the contraction of the Fed's balance sheet coincides with deflation. We had really significant deflationary fears in 2019, and we've definitely seen that there were clear deflationary fears in Europe when they engaged in quantitative tightening back in, and I'm going to say 2012 through 14. So that's the number one tool that central banks have, that they can reduce the size of their balance sheets, they can siphon liquidity out of the market, which reduces leverage and less money chasing the same amount of goods is going to start bringing down the price of those goods. And it's going to start reducing demand in the economy. And the central banks around the world have been exceptionally clear in stating, particularly the Federal Reserve, that this is a demand problem less than a supply problem. And China's exports would support that view. Because if it was all about supply, well, then they wouldn't be exporting as much. But China's exports went through the roof during the pandemic, and that is really more of a supply challenge than a, or excuse me, more of a demand challenge than a supply challenge. Then let's just think about the Baltic Dry Index in terms of the price overall is falling. So that's implying less demand for shipping. And it's beginning to suggest that we've had a big inventory build in most consumer markets, and consumer demand should start to moderate. And we also know that for factories, the PMI might have been positive, but orders are starting to deteriorate. So we may not have had the traditional conditions for a recession yet fulfilled, but that does not mean that they're not going to be fulfilled. I think this is what the market is going to begin to price in over the course of the next few weeks, that we are due some additional pullback in stock markets. Now, when we look at investor sentiment, it was exceptionally negative 2 weeks ago. And we have the number of shares trading above their respective 200-day moving averages, got all the way back down to the region of the lows over the last few years. So it's a natural area where investors might begin to think about some additional buying. But we do have precedent for bounces and reversions. We've seen actually quite a few of those occasions. We've seen it particularly in 98 through 99. And we've seen a good sized rebound, although not quite as large as we've seen in the past on this occasion. But the most important thing is that particularly since 2008, each one of these pullbacks below 20% has coincided with a significant pivot by the Federal Reserve, and they don't appear willing to do the same on this occasion. Now, we can also start to pay attention to what's happening in China. So, obviously, Nancy Pelosi landed in Taiwan today, and that has contributed to additional geopolitical tension. And on her Twitter page, she has a video of when she and a couple of other senators went, or politicians, I don't know, senators, went to Tiananmen Square and unfurled a little banner saying that they support democracy. And that was 28 years ago. So she is definitely boosting her hawkish China credentials. And there's clearly an effort underway within US politics to cast China as their clear adversary and a clear need to try and rein in China's expansionism and I guess geopolitical adventurism. There's also been a very clear change of attitude among Western governments over the last decade. I think it really stems from the Belt and Road Initiative, because that was clearly a sign that China was looking to be more of a globally active power than concentrating on its domestic priorities. And after that, we've seen lots of additional expansionary and outward-looking initiatives, as well as very strong measures to try and regain control or clamp down on protest movements within China. So they obviously continue to think of Taiwan as their number one priority, as a recalcitrant province. And that hasn't changed for decades. And of course, the rest of the world looks on Taiwan as a major exporter of one of the most vital components in the global economy. So They don't want to see China taking the place over by force. So obviously this is a serious point of contention. And it's obviously something that's going to continue to be a really significant talking point. But it's probably a bigger issue for China than it is for everywhere else. And the H-share index was down in negative territory today. I don't believe that there's a strong risk of an accident between two heavily armed foes around Taiwan while there's a big name politician floating around. I think everyone's going to be very careful. It's at any point after this that it's more likely that there will be an accident, which will cause an international crisis. And the fact that China is much more strident and better armed today than it was 25 years ago is certainly something that isn't going to be lost on military commanders. So there's certainly potential for additional volatility. And ultimately, China is going to have to come to terms with the property sector. And because the stock market is considered by domestic Chinese people to be a casino that is run by the Communist Party, and only the most connected have privileged information and can profit from it. And because the domestic bond market is immature, most people put their savings into property. So, in many respects, if we just simply think about the priorities. Within the USA, whenever the stock market pulls back really violently, then the Federal Reserve will intervene because it's the stock market that most people own. And it's certainly something that people attach value to. And the wealth effect and the personal perception of wealth is very much tied to how well the stock market is doing. Then secondarily, it'll be about property. In Germany, most people don't own stocks, but they do own bonds. So then the German bond market tends to be something that people have confidence in. And of course, rising yields have been really rather dramatic this year, but the bond yield has pulled back rather sharply over the course of the last few weeks and is only now beginning to find support. So we're also starting to see support being found by bond yields in Europe. So what this is starting to suggest is that we are still looking at problematic effects in the global economy, and particularly from the perspective of Europe, with a really significant energy crisis unfolding. Then the willingness of the ECB to do whatever is necessary to ensure the integrity of the Eurozone area is going to be absolutely essential. And that means potentially raising rates, but also providing additional assistance to member governments. And of course, that's something that's completely beyond its remit. So they're going to have to change what they're allowed to do, and that's going to require a crisis. And it does look like a crisis is winding up in Europe. So it's going to be difficult for bond yields to come back down. And then China's property market is where we see a lot of focus for retail investors. And they haven't yet figured out how they're going to unwind this massive leverage. And property developers are in rather serious trouble. But I'm looking most at China Vanke as a way to monitor this trend. So we're back in the region of the lows, and it was off the low in here today. I think what China is doing is they're providing almost like an IV. So this isn't going to be the shock treatment. They're going to keep the property sector alive without, or perhaps it might be the better way to think about it is that it's like a chemically induced coma. So they're not going to let it die, but they're not going to massively inflate it either. And that suggests that we could be in for a lengthy period of a lot of messy action. One thing that I think is relevant is we're starting to see that rather defensive type instruments are beginning to rebound. So Mosaic has bounced from the region of the 200-day moving average and was well up off the lows in here today. Nutrien, which focuses more on potash, was also well off the lows over the course of the last few weeks. Then we can also think about some of the arms companies. So they had pulled back over the course of the last few months, but have rebounded really quite emphatically over the last 3 weeks. And that's equally true. There's a lot of commonality across the sector. So, in that this is also true of the drone manufacturers, where they had pulled back from the beginning of the year and are now starting to rebound once more. So, this is also suggesting that investors are willing to bet that regardless of whatever happens, there is going to be rearmament just about everywhere. And this is most particularly true for countries like Germany and Japan, because they're underarmed and they have neighbors that are overarmed. So there's going to have to be a closing of that arbitrage. Of course, the other big arbitrage is in natural gas, and natural gas prices in the US are coming down, but natural gas prices in Europe are still really high. And the only way that this kind of arbitrage is possible is because of the immature nature of the LNG sector. Europe is at capacity for imports, so it doesn't matter how much additional supply comes to market in Europe, they can't take any more. So that's not always going to be the case, but it's going to remain the case until a lot more LNG import facilities are built, and that takes time above everything else. The greatest geopolitical imperative today is to become energy independent. Everybody now understands that relying on volatile, despotic regimes is not a long-term strategy that anyone could describe as viable. So Europe in particular has got to do whatever is necessary to achieve energy independence. And I think that's also contributing to a lot more interest in small modular reactors, and NuScale had it's the first generation 4 plan that's been approved by US regulators. So that resulted in a big pop on the upside for the sector over the last couple of weeks. The uranium sector has been steadying in the region of the upper side of the underlying base formation, the lower side of the first step above the base. And I think that we're quite likely to see a revolution in nuclear production, not least because there's a lot more electric cars are expected to come onto the market. But one of the responses of China to Nancy Pelosi's visit to Taiwan was to announce that CATL isn't going to open their battery factory in the USA. Now, they're the largest manufacturer of batteries in the world, and the share is steadying at the moment in the region of the 200-day moving average. But this is one of China's national champion companies, so it's not going to be allowed to fail, whereas the property sector isn't nearly as well favored any longer. Now, when we think about renewable energy, copper is going to be essential in terms of the build-out of that technology. But China's a major consumer of copper in the commodities sector and the infrastructure sector. So there is certainly a lot of push and pull in the market, and the chart action is negative. We have a very clear, completed top formation. We've had a rebound from a deep oversold condition, and prices are now back below the psychological 350 level. The miners are falling over themselves in terms of just peddling exactly. I've talked to a number of people who were at the at Rick Rule's mining conference in Florida over the course of the last few days, and it seems like miners are peddling exactly the same argument today as they were in Saudi Arabia back in January, and it is that copper demand is about to explode on the upside, and that there's going to have to be this massive mining cycle to increase supply. But that is assuming that demand is a constant. So there's been a tendency in the energy markets to believe that that demand growth is a constant, but demand growth isn't a constant, and it tends to ebb and flow, and particularly for oil in terms of recessions and expansions. But when we start to imply that there's going to be a technological revolution that will change demand, then obviously that is potentially going to accelerate the demand growth cycle. But then you can't take for granted the fact that China's property sector is really problematic, and that they are getting a lot less bang for their buck in terms of infrastructure development. China's recession could significantly kill off demand for copper, whereas the demand in terms of renewable energy might not be strong enough to absorb that additional supply. So that's what the market's telling us. We've had this really significant decline, and the really significant bullish prognostications of the mining sector, they are basically looking only at the rosy picture and ignoring the real trouble that exists in China today. Because it's not just copper. When we look at the LME Metals Index, it's also pulled back really violently. Now, in this case, it's bouncing from the upper side of the underlying trading range and the region of the 1,000-day moving average. But there's still a lot of room for a bounce and then ultimate failure here. So it's certainly some cause to be more cautious about industrial resources when there's so much uncertainty about what's going on in China. And I think with that, I'll leave you for today, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.